There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Yeah, welcome back to The Grill. Just gone 10 past four on your Saturday afternoon. No Tom Ucker. He is back in the UK enjoying a little summer vacation. As myself, Chris McCarty, then joined this afternoon by Mark Archer and Matt Fortune. We are taking a look back on all of the week's biggest sporting stories. We're also keeping an eye on all of the live sport as well. In fact, before we go anywhere else in this second hour, and I promise you, we will be discussing some cricket this hour. We will also be live to Carnoustie for the very latest on day three, the third round, the moving Saturday of the 147th Open Championship. Before we do all of that, though, let us put you in the picture with some live sport. I want to start, if we can, with Super Rugby. We've seen a couple of full-time results from a little earlier today. It is quarter-final weekend. We know now three of the four making their way into next week's semi-finals.
Yeah, the first semi-final next week in Super Rugby will be between two New Zealand teams. The Hurricanes will take on the Crusaders in the first semi-final in Christchurch, New Zealand. And the second semi-final, one of the teams that are through already is the Waratahs from New South Wales. They've just defeated the Highlanders 30 points to 23. A 24-point run in the second half took the Waratahs to victory. They will take on the winners of the match at 5 p.m. UAE time in Johannesburg at Emirates Park, where the Lions will host the Jaguares from Argentina. So semi-final one next week, we'll see the Crusaders host the Hurricanes. Semi-final two sees the Waratahs waiting to see who their opponents are, either the Lions or the Jaguares.
Yeah, it is stage 14 of the Tour de France. I spent my afternoon yesterday just sat on the sofa enjoying stage 13. It would eventually be won by the rock star himself, the world champion Peter Sagan. An 11th, I think it was, stage victory for him in the Tour de France. A third of this 2018 edition. He beat Alexander Kristoff, the UAE Team Emirates rider, to the finish line yesterday. Stage 14 today, Geraint Thomas, the Welshman, the Team Sky rider. He is in possession of the yellow jersey. Still a little breakaway in the early part of this race?
Well, it's a little bit more than a little breakaway, Chris, but don't get too excited when I tell you that that breakaway group is 4 minutes ahead of the peloton. The peloton being controlled by Team Sky. But then when I tell you the highest placed rider in that breakaway is 32 minutes off top spot. That's a young Damiano Caruso from BMC Racing. The weather is causing problems, though. It's certainly not one to switch off from straight away. The crosswinds, one of the Tour de France have posted on Twitter pictures from the finish line, and the trees are billowing something proper up at the top of that mountain there. So it's certainly not one to take your eyes off just yet.
Now, you are a bit of a cyclist, an aficionado. You're out on your bike 90 kilometres plus. You're clocking in every Friday morning up at El Kudra and up to Ras Al Khaimah as well, Matthew Fortune. But one of the things that does intrigue me when I watch Tour de France is the tactics. Is all the tactics. We talk about it, it is very much an individual sport. It is man versus machine. But there's so much of a team collective ethos in all of this as well, because it is incredibly tactical.
Absolutely. I mean, the politics of the peloton is one of the most fascinating things in sport, I think. I mean, even if you, and I appreciate the flattery of what I do on a Friday morning, but it's amazing. When I first started out, I didn't quite understand the value of drafting, essentially, and sitting in behind your rider and how you can share that workload, which is essentially what the peloton is doing. You'll see it. Someone will go to the front, take a big hit of the wind, and then they'll move to the side, and everyone's had a nice, easy ride for about half an hour or so. And I train with a power meter on the bike, so I can see exactly what my speed is against my power. My speed will go up and my power will drop significantly if I sit behind two riders on the Al Kudra track. And it's absolutely fascinating. And that's why when people say, well, the Tour de France, nothing happens until the final few minutes when people sprint off. Actually, from an interest perspective, to watch how somebody can just take a free ride for the best part of 3 hours and then sprint over the line is absolutely fascinating.
It really is.
This is The Grill, live from Barasti, where the game is always on.
Yeah, welcome back. 140 kilometres to go then in stage 14. We will not be seeing the conclusion through before we go off air at 6 o'clock. We should conclude probably, that's a little similar to last night, about 7:30-ish.
Give or take, yeah.
Yeah, that's what we're expecting. Stage 14 of the Tour de France. Another thrilling finish, I'm sure, in store. And I just wonder if Chris Froome, will he attack today as he looks to close that gap? 1 minute 37 seconds behind his Team Sky teammate, Geraint Thomas, in the general classification. We're off to Carnoustie in 10 minutes' time to get the very latest ahead of, ahead of them big leaders, the big men, the men that lead the way at the 147th Open Championship. Zach Johnson, winner. Was he back in 2016 or 2015?
Ooh, that's a good question.
Open Championship winner. 2015, I think it was.
2015, he's also won a Masters, so two times major winner, Zach Johnson. Yeah, he leads the way, tied with fellow American Kevin Kisner both at 6 under par. But Chris, we talked earlier in the show about how benign the conditions are today. They're good for scoring. The rain yesterday has dampened down the fairways. The greens are a bit more receptible. And we're seeing the round of the week put together by the big Englishman from Bristol, Chris Wood. He's 7 under par through 13 holes today. It's a magnificent round of golf. And he has moved up into a tie for third position. He started today at 2 over par, and he's moved all the way to 5 under par, one shot behind the leaders. Will he be the clubhouse leader? Can he find a birdie in the very treacherous last four holes? 7 under par from that man. Also, another great round from another Englishman, Justin Rose, was almost out of it. He's 6 under par today, and he's got himself to 3 under par and right back into the tournament as well. 6 birdies for Justin Rose. So we are seeing movement on moving day Saturday in Carnoustie. Can the big players come out today and put a score underway? We saw Tommy Fleetwood yesterday put the best round of the weekend with a 65. Are we going to see it amongst the leaderboard? The final group won't go out till 7 p.m. UAE time. So over the next couple of hours, we will see all the leading groups get on their way into Carnoustie. Will the weather hold? Will the wind come up? It's always difficult to make these predictions in the treacherous Scottish Highlands to see what will happen with the weather. But at the moment, the wind's not blowing, it's calm, and the players are putting some red numbers on the scoreboard.
Tiger Woods, he gets his round underway very shortly as well. We'll keep an eye on what the great man does over the course of the next hour and 40 minutes before we clock off air. I want to talk cricket, want to talk rugby as well, some of the big stories of the week. I also want to talk Anthony Joshua, because he will be stepping back into the ring on September the 22nd. Going to break away from traditional sports for just a minute, lads, because a story that caught my eye today, and it's a story that we've discussed at length on Sports Tonight regarding eSports. Now, for any of you out there that perhaps are not aware of what eSports is, essentially we're talking gaming, computer gaming. It has become monstrous over the course of the past couple of years. YouTubers, etc. I mean, there's an awful lot of it that I don't really understand. Truth be told, I'm a bit of an old fuddy-duddy, a lot younger than Mark Archer, but still an old fuddy-duddy. But eSports is booming. There's been an awful lot of discussion in the past couple of days. I'm seeing an awful lot of reports and articles written about it. And again, the subject of inclusion in the Olympics has popped up. I've got to get your boys' thoughts on this. Esports, I mean, you've got to respect it. It is going to become, and I think it already is, a billion-dollar industry with all the young kids, the millennials, taking to it. There's a number of games. I mean, FIFA's the obvious one, but I appreciate there's games like Fortnite and World of Warcraft, and I'm getting off-piste a little bit. There's an awful lot of games out there that I'm just not up to speed with. But esports itself, it's becoming an absolute monster, and that is why we're now at the discussion of perhaps it joining the Olympic movement. Thoughts?
From an Olympic perspective, Chris, I think we're probably some way off that. But from a spectacle and a classification and a more widespread appreciation, I think we're certainly there. As you say, a billion-dollar industry, thousands and thousands and thousands of people packing into stadiums to watch people stare at a screen. It's fascinating. I mean, I was always hopeless, and it's opening up old wounds of being beaten in my shared house at university regularly at FIFA games. But I think anything that requires competition, pitching one person against another person, hand-eye coordination, it has all the elements of a well-respected sport. And I think, as you say, we're moving forward. It's 2018. It just is what it is. I think Olympics is probably slightly pushing it, but from a widespread appreciation perspective, I think it's definitely there.
You mentioned there about thousands taking to stadiums, and you're right to point that out. There was an event over in Birmingham this past Friday. 9,000 spectators packed in. I think sold out 27,000 tickets across the 3 days of this event. Reading this report, all the guests in, or all the spectators, were aged between about 18 and 30. The video game in question was Dota 2. Again, I'm pretending I know what I'm talking about. I don't. It is apparently it is a very popular game out there, but these individuals paying £20 a ticket just to get in to watch these talented individuals play a computer game. It sounds nonsensical, but it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And Mark Archer, you're a man that's worked in sponsorship and marketing. You have managed some very, very impressive talents. I think to Alan Donald, I think to Chris Eubank as well, senior that is. Esports, Do you see this one day taking over from traditional modes of sport?
I think it's opening up a new demographic. Obviously, it's interesting that it's attracted such large numbers to I see sports as a participation. You want to play. I don't personally understand the appeal of watching other people play electronic games. Yeah. I don't get that. But obviously, it's as popular. I know it's massive in parts of Asia. They fill stadiums, and that obviously we've seen by that event in Birmingham that it's incredibly popular as well. So I think the Olympic movement's always interested in sports that appeals to different demographics. It brings in a different TV audience. And then, again, it opens up doors to new sponsors, new commercial revenues. Whether it takes quickly, whether it's a fad, let's wait and see. I think it might have some attraction in the Youth Olympics, which is sort of a junior version of the Olympics. But we've seen the IOC bring in new sports in recent years. We've seen the advent of, in the Winter Olympics, the half pike and the sort of freestyle skiing. We've seen in the full Summer Olympics, surfing's now been added.
Yep.
So that's efforts to open up to different demographics, to different markets, to appeal to popular sports. So I guess let's wait and see how it sort of unravels. Again, I personally, I don't understand why someone would want to watch someone else play computer games. But a lot of people do, so who am I to criticise it?
An awful lot of people do. 380 million esports viewers globally. That's the recent figures that have been released. It's a business that is ballooning. 35% up on last year, the revenues from esports. And it's an economy that right now is estimated to be worth about 675 million. As of 2020, they are expecting it to smash through the £1 billion mark. That is. So it's trending in the right direction. It's just whether Matt, and Mark makes the point, is it a fad right now? Will the youth generation of tomorrow move on to something else? Or is it here to stay? And is it going to play a large part in the landscape of sport moving forward? That, I guess, is the million-dollar question.
Well, I would suggest the consistent development of the games help it. So you're not relying on things that we're not in control of, necessarily the improvement of human performance. Those games and those platforms will always be developing, as they have done. You think back to when you and I were kids playing on Sega Mega Drive,
Nintendos.
I think there's a very clear differentiation that we need to make, though, and that is, and to my mind, it was my own lack of knowledge, is that esports doesn't necessarily mean sports games.
Absolutely.
And there's been a lot of discussion after this exploratory meeting between the IOC and those in charge of esports, and there's a lot of concern about the promotion of what they would be on the screen, and that is violence in computer games. That's a whole other discussion that's probably too dangerous for us to go down at this point, but I think there needs to be a clear direction as to which competitions we would be focusing on, because something like that to a global audience of the Olympics, I think, would be pushing things a bit too far.
It is extraordinary as well, the sums that these individuals are earning. There are football clubs now, and I think of Wolfsburg, I know Manchester City, Manchester United are exploring it as well, PSG, paying money. And for many of you that perhaps missed this story, there are individuals now earning a full-time salary to play a computer game for football clubs. Football clubs are diversifying because, of course, you're tapping in to such a large audience. There is a huge, huge thirst for esports. It is very much watch this space on that one, but could we see esports in the Olympics shortly? I'm still batting the drum for squash, certainly, and for darts. I want to see darts in there.
Well, I think that's the point, Chris. I think there is a number of actual sports that probably would be saying, excuse me guys, we're over here doing our own thing.
Don't get me started on that soapbox. It's with regards to squash. It is a sport tailor-made for Olympics. I'm not going to go over old ground, but I would suggest that it would have a finer argument right now than esports, but certainly watch this space because, as I say, the viewership figures are huge. It is a behemoth, and it's only going to get bigger over the course of, I'm sure, the next few years. Watch this space on all things esport. I'm keen to get back to live sport as well. Qualifying in German Grand Prix, we're expecting that in about 35 minutes, 5 o'clock over in Germany.
Yes, exactly right, and we're hoping for a little bit more drama than was caused in the final practice, Chris, where only 9 drivers registered a time. The weather is atrocious over there. It's in Germany, and we had a Sauber 1-2. The only driver that is holding any interest from a general watching perspective is Sebastian Vettel, who clocked the 4th quickest time in final practice. But like I say, there was only 9 drivers that were able to do so. The rain is horrendous.
I'll make a bold prediction now. If it's raining cats and dogs over there in Hockenheim Ring, I expect Lewis Hamilton to be on pole. He is the master in the rain. Watch this space on that one. We will bring you blow by blow qualifying as and when it starts at about 5 p.m. this evening. Going to cross back over to the golf because Mark Archer, well, I was poking fun at Mark Archer before we started the show this afternoon because he sent me a text message on Sports Tonight in the week with about 6 names of individuals he thought had a good chance of winning at the Open Championship this weekend, and I scoffed because no one was in contention. What happens? Justin Rose goes out, he shoots a 7-under par, and he's given himself a fantastic opportunity.
Yeah, best round of the week over at Carnoustie. The 147th Open Championship has come from the man from Hampshire. Justin Rose has gone out today and finished his round in 7-under par, 64. That's one shot better than fellow countryman Tommy Fleetwood, 65 yesterday, and he's rocketed up the scoreboard. He wasn't anywhere in contention up until today's round, and he's gone to 4-under par. That's only two shots off the lead. He's finished his round in 64 shots, 7-under par today. A fantastic round of golf for Justin Rose. The other man we were talking about, Chris Wood, well, he was going along really well. He was also at 7-under par, but he's just bogeyed the 14th par 5. He's taken a 6 there, and he's dropped back to 4-under par, 6-under par for his round. But one man we will be talking about throughout the rest of the afternoon is Tiger Woods. Two rounds of 71. Can the 14-time major winner get back into the event with and go low today? Let's just have a listen to Tiger Woods talking about his round of 71 yesterday.
You know, I got off to not exactly the best start, you know, being 2 over through 3, but got it back. And, you know, the golf course was a little bit softer today. Obviously, it rained, and we were able to get the ball down a little bit further, control the ball on the ground a little bit easier today, which was nice. And, you know, certainly birdies could be had out there. You know, most of my success, you know, obviously twice over at St. Andrews, you know, I've played well in Scotland, and I haven't played the Open Championship for a couple of years. And so it's just fantastic to have the support where we have. And for as many people that came out in the rain today and supported us, and, you know, obviously the 9 is one of the furthest points from the golf course, and they walked all the way around cheering for us, and certainly it's very appreciative. I played a little bit better yesterday. Today wasn't quite as good, but I finally birdied a par 5. So that's a positive. Right now I'm 6 back, and, you know, by the day's end, I think I'll be more than that. It'll be a pretty packed leaderboard, and I'm certainly right there in it. Well, they were slower yesterday in the afternoon. They were bumpier. Today they were obviously a little bit slow, but they were smooth. And it was nice to have a little bit smoother greens. You know, you can see a lot of guys are making birdies out there. The greens are a little bit smoother, and they're rolling a little bit better.
Tiger Woods speaking there after a second successive level par round over at Carnoustie. I can tell you he has taken to the course to begin his third round. He's just parred his opening hole. So Tiger Woods remains at level par for the tournament. He's 6 shots behind the two leaders, Zach Johnson and Kevin Kistner. One thing about Tiger Woods as well, you feel, if he can catch fire, I've been watching an awful lot of him, Mark Archer, consistency still not there. He's hitting some beautiful shots into the greens. His putting, perhaps, still a little lacking. But if he can catch fire today, he's going to whip a frenzy amongst the capacity crowd that will be over there at Carnoustie. If he can maybe go 4-under today, you never know, he could be 2-3, within 2 or 3 of the lead heading into the final day.
Yeah, Tiger Woods has come back with a bang this year. He's been out for a long time with the injury he suffered last year at the Dubai Desert Classic. And we thought, would he ever come back? He dropped into the thousands in the world rankings. He's now back in the top 100. He's had the chance to win PGA Tour events. He just hasn't been able to put 4 consistent rounds together. But can he go low today? Well, the conditions are made for him. One man that the conditions are really made for, that likes it a bit soft, likes it a bit long, doesn't like the wind, and there's no wind at Carnoustie, is the man from Northern Ireland, the 2014 Open champion, Rory McIlroy. He'll be teeing off later today, and he'll be thinking, if Justin Rose can go 7-under, if Chris Wood can get a score together, well, there's no reason why Rory McIlroy can't put a big round together and really move up the leaderboard. Well, he's starting the day in a good position. He's at 4-under par, only 2 shots off the leader, and Rory will go into today very optimistic after a good round yesterday.
Yeah, I'm happy. You know, I feel like I played in the toughest of the conditions, and definitely our side of the draw was, you know, we had to sort of tough it out a little bit. It was a little more difficult. So I'm happy to, you know, be in with a shout, and hopefully I can go out and play well again tomorrow. And then, you know, that'll be a big chance going into Sunday. I don't want to say easy, but it's felt comfortable. So, you know, if I can get on a run or get off to a fast start one of the next couple of days, I don't see a ridiculously low score out there, but I definitely see something like what Tommy shot today, a 66 or a 65. I'm capable of that, yeah.
4-time major winner there, Rory McIlroy. He will start his round at 20-7 UAE time. He is 2 shots behind the leaders, Zach Johnson and Kevin Kistner. We are set for a barnstorming moving Saturday over at Carnoustie. And when we come back, we're on the phone to a young lady who has got a front row seat to it all. Ali Defoy will be live from Carnoustie when we come back.
Unbelievable goal!
This is The Grill, live from Barasti, where the game is always on.
Welcome back to the show. The game is always on. We are 25 minutes away from qualifying over at the Hockenheim Ring in Germany. Of course, the Formula One roadshow heading to Germany this weekend. All eyes will be on, I'm sure, Mercedes. Can they bounce back after a disappointing couple of races? Sebastian Vettel, of course, in his home race. Keep your texts coming in on 4001. An awful lot of you getting in touch. And a big thank you to Luciano as well, who's been in touch. We were discussing a little earlier esports and the growth of esports, not just here in the region, but of course across the world as well. It is on the up and up. We're discussing one day, perhaps, who knows, it could be added to the Olympic movement. Luciano's been in touch on 4001. He says, glad you guys spoke about esports on your radio show today. Not enough has been said in the region. If you need insights or scoops, I'll be happy to help. Luciano, incidentally, is club director of Nasser Esports, the leading regional esports team. So Luciano, I may just do that. Watch this space. I'll give you a little buzz in the not too distant future. We will be looking in a lot more detail about esports. For now, though, it is all about moving Saturday over at the beautiful Carnoustie in Scotland. There is the 147th Open Championship, and I'm delighted to say that one lady, who I did say a little earlier, has a front row seat to all the action. She joined us on Sports Tonight on Thursday, and I'm delighted to say that Ali Defoy once again joins us over live from Carnoustie. And I will say a very good afternoon to you, Ali.
Good afternoon to you, Chris. Hi, Mark. How are you?
We're very well this side, indeed, Ali. We are enjoying all of our sporting, I guess, intrigue this afternoon. None more so than the 147th Open Championship. It has been a fantastic tournament thus far. You, as I say, have been there all week long, mixing with the biggest hitters in the world of golf. Give us a little summary of exactly what fans are being treated to today, Ali.
Oh, my word, it's tremendous. I don't know if you've just seen, but Justin Rose just had a spectacular round. He just came in on -7, over the moon for him today. The sun has started to burn through the clouds. It looks a bit dull on TV, but it's actually a lot brighter here. The seagulls are still going. It's a wonderful day, and it's busy, busy, busy today.
Yeah, great to see the crowds turn out. And as you rightly point out, Justin Rose, what a round he's put together. The best round of the week thus far, a 7-under par 64. That has catapulted himself into contention. He's 4-under, 2 shots back. The leading lights will be heading out in the coming hours, Ali. None more so, I guess, from a gallery perspective, and he always attracts a big crowd. It is Tiger Woods. You have been in his press conferences this past week. How is Tiger in terms of his demeanour, Ali? Have you been impressed with how he is going about his business over the course of those opening two rounds?
You know, he has been absolutely lovely. He's super grateful. Ninth hole in the course is one of the furthest away for any spectator really to get to, and they were out in their droves yesterday, and in his press conference he couldn't thank them enough. The weather wasn't grand yesterday. It was a bit dreary, as we say in Scotland, but he certainly appreciated it very much so.
Ali, great that you can join us on the show. You just talked about how well Justin Rose did today. Fellow Englishman Chris Wood is also having a good round. One player with a lot of expectation today must be Rory McIlroy, who favours the conditions. It looks like a great day for scoring. How do you expect Rory McIlroy to go today? Is he getting a lot of support from the local crowd?
He absolutely is, yeah. I mean, he thinks he can get a 65 and a 66 today. So he's not been as consistent as Tiger was yesterday. His fairways haven't been too strong. He's only been hitting sort of 27% of the fairways and 47% yesterday. His putts have come down. He's happy with how he's doing. He seems relaxed, and he thinks he's capable of it. So he's just quite comfortable and quite happy. So he wants to try and do some wood hitting, of course, today. It's been more the irons yesterday with the weather conditions, but hopefully he'll be able to get his woods out and drive a wee bit further today.
And Ali, we know the weather can change quickly and rapidly up in that part of Scotland, and the course can also change. We saw on day one it was windy. We saw yesterday it was the rain. What are the conditions for today? How will it affect play throughout the day, or will it remain relatively benign and players can put some good scores away?
Yeah, I reckon so. I mean, the maximum winds today are 5 miles per hour, which for Carnoustie is nothing really. I think it's going to be pretty even across the board for everyone today. Obviously, the course will dry out a wee bit as the day goes on. The sun's starting to burn through, so that'll change it a little bit, but nothing like yesterday.
I'll take you back to Thursday night if I can, Ali. You did say you had a little fancy for a certain Tony Finau, and he's playing well, 4 under par, a 67 backed up with a 71. Of the individuals that you have seen, and I know you're watching an awful lot over there, you're of course working, you're interviewing the boys as they come off that 18th green as well. Anyone that stood out for you? Is there anyone worth just a little that we maybe need to keep a closer eye on?
Do you know, I think everyone's forgetting Matt Kuchar. He's had 4 top 8 finishes in his majors. He had a 70 and then a 64. He's on -4. He's tied 7th. I think he's a good shout. Obviously, last year at Royal Birkdale, he was a runner-up. At the Olympics 2016, he got a bronze. Everyone seems to be sort of missing him, I think, this year. I think he might be a good shout.
Absolutely, not wrong there as well. 4 under par. Another man that we've mentioned as well, and Mark Archer had a doozy of a start a little earlier. Nick Faldo, the last Englishman to win an Open Championship, which year?
1992. So a long time between 92. Drinks for the English, and we saw that great round by Tommy Fleetwood yesterday, but also Justin Rose, the man from Hampshire, and also Chris Wood having a magnificent round today.
Absolutely. Tommy Fleetwood, talk to me about him. I've had the pleasure of interviewing him a few times, Ali. He is a bit of a throwback. He is very much your man on the street. I guess that part is why he is so very popular amongst fans, and he's a heck of a golfer as well.
He's absolutely lovely. He was in the fan zone just the other day, signing everything and anything for everybody. He couldn't give them enough time. He was there for every single person, all the crew as well, making sure that everybody who was looking after the sort of fan zone, all the staff, were getting their signatures as well. He's a lovely chap. I don't know whether he thought he would make it through, though, because his caddy phoned the camping village last night when we were doing some filming to ask if there was a tent that he could get so we had somewhere to stay for the next 2 nights. Unfortunately, there wasn't. There was no luck at the camping site, so I don't know where he stayed last night.
Oh, Ellie, that's just caddies for you. They're looking for the cheapest bargain they can get. They're all Scottish, the caddies. Just like Chris McCarty. One question I want to ask you is there's plenty of big names now moving up the leaderboard, but a lot of high-profile players have missed the cut. The likes of the world number one, Dustin Johnson. Disappointing day for him at 6 over par. Justin Thomas, the world number two, he finished at 4 over par. But also the likes of Sergio Garcia, Martin Kaymer, Charles Schwartz, or Ernie Els, all missed the cut. What went wrong for those players? What happened to them? And is the crowd disappointed that some of those big names won't be there for the weekend?
Do you know, I think the crowd are just excited to be here. The fact that Woods is still in contention, I think they're still excited. It's the first time in 7 years that a world number one has missed the cut. Of course, it was Luke Donald back in 2011, so it's a bit of a shock. That's 3 out of the world top 5 that have missed it, with Ram, sorry Chris, but Ram missing out as well.
You remember that, Ali. He was my tip on Thursday night, John Ram. It's all right, don't you worry. Just call me out on air, it's fine. I'll let you off.
Well, no, but he was a good shout, but I think his patience, which is what Rory was talking about, is that you need patience with this course, with the weather, with the conditions. It's a huge waiting game and a patience game. And I think that's what went wrong, yesterday with some of the weather conditions.
You mentioned there that the crowds as well have been good. I read a report today, one article was saying that perhaps the crowds are a little down. The one journalist was daring to suggest that perhaps Carnoustie, the location of it, the lack of accessibility to the course had maybe brought the crowds down. And he was actually calling perhaps for the R&A to look at Carnoustie as a host moving forward. From what you've seen, the galleries are still busy enough?
Well, to be fair, in the first week, it surpassed 157,000 that Paul Laurie had in 1995 when he defeated John Vandeveld. So, I mean, it's still busy. It was one of the fastest-selling championship opens to ever be staged in Scotland. So I think that, I don't know, maybe it's a bit more spaced out. Maybe they're not seeing as many crowds sort of squashed together. Maybe it doesn't maybe look as big for them. But it's been a big seller.
It has certainly been. And listen, if we can see Rory McIlroy and we can see Tiger Woods produce some fireworks over the course of the next few hours, then I'm sure it will be bumper crowds tomorrow afternoon to see the finale of the 147th Open Championship. Bless you, Ali. Thank you so much for sparing 10 minutes or so to catch up with us this afternoon. My final question to you, you've mentioned Matt Kuchar. Your fancy at the start was Tony Finau. Who's winning this?
I think it's impossible to say. Absolutely. Anything can happen here. I mean, Justin Rose, I'd love him to win. I mean, he's had 18 out of 22
Justin Rose.
Top 10 finishes.
Yeah, he's
Why
put himself
not?
In
I
contention.
I spoke to Paddy the other day. He wants to win. He doesn't want to just be a sort of a nearly. He's driven. He's so on it. I think he'll do well. I'm
like it.
Tony and Justin.
Tony and Justin, I'm glad we've got you to nail your colours to the mast. Tony for now, Justin Rose, you've heard it here first. Ali DeFoy, thank you so much. Bless you. We will be catching up with you again tomorrow evening on Sports Tonight. But you enjoy the rest of your day, and we look forward to catching up with you again tomorrow night.
Absolutely. Thanks, guys. Take care.
Great stuff there. That is Ali DeFoy live from Carnoustie. She's enjoying herself. And why not, Mark Archer? Because you look at that leaderboard. Justin Rose has put himself into contention. Ali makes the great point about Matt Kuchar. The Cooch, we've not really discussed him. Rory McIlroy still to go. And the other two names that jump out at me on this leaderboard, Ricky Fowler, who's looking to break his major duck, and Jordan Spieth, the defending champion. He's only three shots back on three under par, a 67 for Spieth yesterday. If he can come out and putt the way we know he can, who knows, Jordan Spieth could go back-to-back in this Open.
Yeah, two players that can be right in the mix. And you talk about Matt Kuchar, of course, he finished second last year at the Open Championship behind Jordan Spieth. So there's plenty of talent on the leaderboard. They are moving. Conditions are very good for scoring. As we've seen, Justin Rose, 7 under par, round of 64 today. We've seen Chris Wood play the last two holes. He's at 6 under for the day. And the Japanese player, Yasuko Matsuyoshi, is also in the leaderboard, in the clubhouse, with a 6 under par round also today. So he's gone well. Players are scoring. There is plenty of red on the leaderboard. And there are birdies out there to make for the players. So let's wait and see. These Opens, like Carnoustie, tend to need a bit of wind to really spice things up. They've had that in the first 2 days. Today is perfect for scoring, and we're seeing plenty of red numbers on the leaderboard.
Yeah, we will keep you up to date with the early part of Tiger Woods round. What about the Tour de France as well? An awful lot of you getting in touch on 4001, pleading with us to give you an update on what's going on. Still a long way to go in stage 14. It's hotting up nicely. Is that breakaway group, are they still clocking in the minutes?
It's ticking along quite nicely, Chris. They've now stretched the lead to over 5.5 minutes. It's still the same sort of group. There's a little bit of jostling for position. I think there's a lot of riders from a lot of different teams in the group. So going back to the point we were discussing earlier about the politics of big group cycling, there's a little bit of jostling. It's maybe not letting them have the biggest impact that they possibly could. The weather is continuing to cause problems, but this is one that I'm not taking my eyes off, Chris. 5:40 gap. It's definitely one to watch, and we've got about 110 kilometres to go.
Yeah, we've been talking up Geraint Thomas and the fact that he is the man in possession of the fabled yellow jersey. We've had a text in from Al, and he's making the point, and thank you very much for getting in touch on 4001, Al, that we've got a little short memories, because you go back to the Giro d'Italia, Chris Froome looked out of it. He then produced one of the greatest stages ever seen, really, to win, I think it was stage 19, that just took the Giro d'Italia away from his rivals. He would go on to win that, become the third man to have won all three of the majors, the Tour de France, the Vuelta de España, and the Giro d'Italia. He's got to produce something not too dissimilar if he is to wrestle this yellow jersey away, though, from Geraint Thomas. There's going to be fireworks from Chris Froome over the coming days, and there needs to. We're now in stage 14. The next 3-4 days, Chris Froome's got to attack.
And that's the thing with Froome. He has always got one mesmerising performance in his locker. And you look back, I think, to his first win on Vont 2. Yeah. It was absolutely astonishing stuff. It drew parallels with some of the greatest rideries in the history of the sport. And that is why I find this sport so fascinating. I love the Tour. It's 3 weeks. How many sporting events could you watch for three whole weeks of the same thing and
FIFA
still
World
not
Cup
being entirely sure what's going to happen in it?
Yeah, that is the beauty of it. And I think that is part of the intrigue with this 2018 edition of the Tour de France. And you can hear in my voice, I am genuinely excited about it, because Geraint Thomas has emerged. The politics now involved at Team Sky, Sir Dave Brailsford, the team director, he's got a big decision to make. I know that the party line will be, no, the two men just go out and race, but you know discussions will be had on that team bus each and every day as to how they want this to pan out. And perhaps, maybe, just maybe, it is seen that this is Geraint Thomas's chance, a bit like Bradley Wiggins passing the baton on to Chris Froome back in 2012-13. Maybe that's a similar case this time around.
Well, interestingly, you remember the year that Wiggins won, that Froome did try and make that breakaway,
he
of
did.
Course, famously, and it led to a spat, I believe, on Twitter between the respective riders' wives, no less. There hasn't been any of that this year so far. Thomas has really been given free rein to put the pedal down when he needed to. So it's certainly one to watch. I mean, stupidly, perhaps, I think, surely Sky for a bit of good publicity will maybe keep Froome off the top of the podium. But I think the problem is that where the cynicism of Froome comes, it also goes with Team Sky. It's not necessarily a personal attack. Brailsford hardly covered himself in glory throughout the whole of this fallout around Froome. It's a very difficult man to speak to or get any sort of information from. But it would be interesting to see what happens if Thomas has been given any team orders or not, but he's certainly not sticking to them if he has.
We'll keep an eye on it. 125 kilometres, a little under that to go, 115 in actual fact left. So we will keep an eye on it over the course of the next hour and 10 minutes. We are 15 minutes out from the final Super Rugby quarter-final down in Johannesburg at altitude. It is the Lions taking on the Jaguars from Argentina, and they are bidding to do something they've never done before, and that is win in South Africa. We'll give you team news when we come back. I'm also keen to pick the boys' brains on a couple of the other big stories this past week, namely that Sam Warburton, the Wales and British and Irish Lions captain, forced to retire from the game of rugby at the age of 29. It bodes the question, modern day rugby, is it too brutal? I'll be posing that question to the boys when we come back.
This is The Grill, bringing you the biggest sports stories right now on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Yeah, welcome back to the show. Still plenty of transfer news to put you in the picture with. I did mention a little earlier, Everton getting ready to spend £50 million on a player who has yet to play for his country. He has not won, and I appreciate that that's not the be-all and end-all, but when you're spending £50 million on a player who has yet to be capped by his country, you've got to scratch your head over that one. We'll tell you about that after 5 o'clock, so stay tuned for that. I want to look back, though, on one of the week's big stories, certainly coming out of the world of rugby. Sad news concerning Sam Warburton, an absolute, I guess, a Hercules-type character. Tarzan, that's what I was looking for, Tarzan. A bit of a Tarzan, bit of an all-action. Someone who I've had the pleasure of meeting, albeit very briefly. Lovely man, forced to retire at the age of 29.
Yeah, the British and Irish Lions captain from that drawn series in New Zealand, Welsh rugby captain for a long time, 49 times he captained his country, two World Cups.
Man that led the Lions down in your neck of the
74 Welsh caps. Yeah, a man that's done it all, really, in the world of rugby. He's achieved a lot. He's won Six Nations titles. He's done everything. But you would have thought in the peak of his career, age 29, all that experience now, forced to retire with recurring injuries that he just can't get over. And he hasn't been able to play since that very well led tour to New Zealand last year, the toughest place in sport almost to go and get a result. The Lions had that drawn series. He came away with a lot of kudos and public acclaim for his captaincy, his ability to lead a team of four different nations and bring that team together to get that result. And very sad times. And I guess it shows how attritional rugby is, modern day rugby. He was a guy that always laid his body on the line for his team, whoever he was playing for, whether it being Cardiff, Wales, or the Lions. And it's a shame when a man that should have gone and led Wales to a World Cup, a third World Cup in Japan next year, is forced to retire. He got injured in that tour. He had some injury, some surgery, and he hasn't been able to recover in the 12 months since they came back from that tour. And it's a desperate shame. He's a very well liked person, very well respected. His leadership skills are unparalleled, and he'll go down as a great leader of those three teams: Cardiff, Wales and the British and Irish Lions.
You look at rugby, you watch it week in and week out. The players are getting much bigger than what they were 20 years or so ago. They're getting quicker, they're getting faster, they're more powerful. We're seeing concussion becoming an ever more prevalent issue within the sport of rugby. Is it getting too brutal? I mean, what is the way ahead? Obviously, there will be those that say Sam Warburton is just one of many. There are not many players that are being, I guess, their careers are being curtailed at their very peak. Sam Warburton on this occasion, sadly, his career is over. But I mean, rugby, it is getting, it's monstrous. Some of the hits, week in and week out, I genuinely feel pain just watching it.
Well, I think rugby got too brutal for me, Chris, when I was about 11 years old, and I kept growing upwards, and everybody else in school started growing outwards. It's an interesting point. The thing is that it's the theatre of the sport. Yeah. It is, like you say, it's the thing that people remember. Everybody remembers that big hit. Especially for casual observers who don't necessarily appreciate the intricacies of quick hands through the back line or the way that people scrummage properly, it's the thing that attracts the biggest attention. Is it being taken seriously enough, the dangers? There's some interesting quotes from Gareth Davis, the head of the Welsh Rugby Union, who is suggesting that tackling
has moved ever more higher up the body. Yeah. And while the rules have come in to stop, obviously, the head-high tackles, the move to dislodge the ball that's wrapped underneath this giant bicep just under the shoulder, that's where people are tackling now. And it's such a fine line, and that is where the problems are being caused.
One of the other issues now is that you get so many more substitutions, tactical substitutions in rugby. In the olden day of Test rugby, you could only come off when you're injured. You couldn't substitute players. So what that means is you have impact players. So players come on for 15 minutes, 20 minutes, and are bigger and stronger and faster, and it leads to bigger collisions. Whereas the game used to get more open, it used to be sort of, you know, get a bit more looser in the final 15 minutes. And to last an 80 minutes game of rugby, the players had to be leaner. They couldn't be as big because you couldn't carry your weight around for a full-time match. So you had to be lighter, you had to be more physically nimble. Fit, and you couldn't carry the strength. Now as you're built for 60 minutes or 50 minutes, and then you're built to come on as an impact, so the players are bigger, and that cardiovascular aspect of it's taken away from it. So it's a very sad thing. It's just the modern, you know, the colossus, you know, nature of rugby, the gladiatorial, you know, contact sport that it is. It's incredibly physical, and it's a shame for a man in his prime to be denied playing in another World Cup next year for Wales. You know, it's a sad moment. So a lot of tributes have been paid to Sam Warburton, none more so than the former Wales flanker Martin Williams. This is what he had to say in paying tribute to the retiring Lions captain, Sam Warburton.
It's always a thing when you're a player, you think you can go on forever. I know it's cliched, but you do, you know, you think I'm going to do this forever. So, you know, when you see he's still only 29, he's still incredibly young, he's still got so much to give to the game and offer to the game, and that it is sad. But, you know, we say on one hand it's not a surprise because, you know, we heard he was having a year off. Obviously took the year off after the Lions, had a couple of operations, and you knew he'd gone back into pre-season training a couple of weeks ago, and I spoke to him a couple of weeks ago, and he was chomping at the bit. He really was. He couldn't wait to get back and start training again. But, you know, as we spoke about off air, until you actually get back to training and that intensity of how players and professional rugby players train these days, you know, you're never quite sure how the body's going to react. And by all accounts, it hasn't reacted good. And he's made the decision that, I know it was in the back of his head last year.
Yeah.
But, you know, having gone back, obviously he's realised, he said, you know, everybody will advise him and give him advice, and older players, parents, agents, everybody will give him advice, but the only person who ever knows, you know, will be Sam.
Yeah.
And if he's adamant that he should retire, then it's the right decision.
It's a really difficult thing for anyone outside of his family to know whether his body can stand up to it, whether this is a snap reaction to the first 3 weeks of training, whether this has been in his head for a year. You know, knowing people around him, speaking to people around him, it might have been in his head in the past. Looking at him in training the last 2 weeks, it probably hasn't been in his head until he's doing those training sessions.
Yeah, like I say, you know, I was fortunate enough to at his testimonial dinner a few weeks ago and speaking to him about, you know, just getting back into training, he couldn't wait. He'd sort of that year off, he felt to recharge his battery, that hunger was there, and maybe psychologically it's there, your brain is there, but if the body's, you know, is listed in category of injuries, and it's not just, you know, torn calves or, you know, grade one or grade two hamstring tear, which he has serious surgery, and he has from, I've known him since he was 18, 19, you know, every other season he seems to be out for 6 months or 5 months, really serious injuries. So it comes to a point where, you know, the body can only take so much, and the way, you know, what he's put his body through over the last decade is, you know, there's not many players I can think of who have done that, and I've had to have to continually fight and be in rehab. And, you know, I was sort of lucky as a player. There's only once or twice I had those long, you know, longest I ever out of the game is 4 months.
Yeah.
But then mentally that broke me,
yeah,
not being able to play for 4 months and not being part of the group and having to be with the physio and just rehabbing. So when you look at Sam, he's been doing that constantly throughout his career. You know, it's probably got to the point where I can't be doing this anymore, and that's totally understandable.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.